The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, Revised and Expanded Edition. Chapter 15, Commercial Trade Exchanges, Their Present Limitations and Promising Future. Since the 1970s, the commercial trade exchange industry has been providing a way for small and medium-sized businesses to trade goods and services with one another with less need for government fiat currencies and less reliance on borrowing from banks. Applying the credit clearing process, which we described earlier in connection with the Veer Economic Circle Cooperative, commercial trade exchanges offset their members' debits from purchases against their credits from sales. Since then, the commercial trade exchange industry has continued to develop and grow and has achieved enough market success to suggest that it could become a much more significant force in providing a way for their members to pay one another with less need for government and central bank fiat currencies, while at the same time strengthening small businesses and local and regional economies. Most commercial trade exchanges, however, while they have had greater levels of successes and staying power than their grassroots, not-for-profit counterparts, remain small and barely visible even within their local economies. In this chapter, we will address the questions of why commercial trade exchanges have not yet been able to tap more than a tiny fraction of their potential markets and what might be done to change that. Commercial trade exchanges, often improperly called barter exchanges, provide services that enable business-to-business trading outside of conventional marketing channels and, to a large extent, without the use of conventional money. These two elements together constitute the value proposition that is offered to trade exchange members or clients, and for which they pay sizable fees, mostly in cash. According to the International Reciprocal Trade Association, or IRTA, the leading trade association for what is now being called the modern trade and barter industry, the hundreds of commercial trade exchanges operating in various parts of the world now collectively enable billions of dollars worth of trades annually among their members. Although hard, up-to-date figures are not readily available, IRTA estimates that in 2024, the industry overall enabled trades worth more than $12 billion. During the COVID crisis of 2020 to 2022, the industry suffered a significant contraction as many of its small business clients were negatively impacted by loss of business to online merchants and large corporate chains due to social distancing and, in many cases, government mandates that declared them to be non-essential, forcing them to close long enough to cause them mortal harm. Since then, the industry has slowly recovered along with the small businesses that comprise the market for its services, but it has seen little growth. In the early days, many so-called barter exchanges sprang up, thrived for a season, and then passed from the scene. Most of those that failed were ill-conceived or mismanaged, many being operated by entrepreneurs and marketers who had little understanding of the business and sometimes even fewer scruples. The industry has matured a great deal since then, and those exchanges that remain are, for the most part, reasonably well-run and profitable. But in moving from the entrepreneurial stage to the consolidation stage of development, the industry seems to have reached a plateau, and there is a rising concern among exchange operators that their future survival is in doubt. I believe that most operators of commercial barter exchanges have still not fully comprehended either their main value proposition and the enormity of their potential market, or their importance to the future of our economies, or indeed to the future of civilization. In conversations I've had over the years with leading exchange executives, I've been told that there is a great deal of complacency and reluctance to depart from their old ways of doing things. Many exchange owners are approaching retirement age and are hoping to be bought out. This has helped to spur the wave of consolidation that has been underway for several years. Firms like IMS and ITEX have been buying up a number of small local exchanges and thereby creating larger, more geographically dispersed transaction networks that provide more trading opportunities to their clients. Others, like TradeBank and BarterCard International, are offering franchises as a way of expanding their moneyless trading networks. Industry veteran and former IRTA president David Wallach now deceased, expected this pattern to continue for some time into the future, and his insight has proven to be correct. But despite continued improvement in ethical and operational standards, there are still some widespread practices within the industry that have been limiting and counterproductive. I offer here my assessment of these limiting perceptions and practices and provide recommendations that I consider necessary for the industry to move into the mature stage of its development. These recommendations, if followed, can enable operators in the modern trade and barter industry to achieve unprecedented levels of success for themselves while providing essential services to the millions of small and medium-sized businesses that are the backbone of community economies around the world. Limiting factors. The limiting factors that I perceive in current operations of commercial trade exchanges include the following, which I will address in order. 1. Limited scope and scale of membership. A. Insufficient numbers of business participants. B. Limited variety of goods and services available within clearing circles. C. Limited geographic coverage. D. Failure to penetrate all levels of the supply chain. They are focused almost exclusively on recruiting members who operate at the retail level. And E. Failure to allow consumers, or prosumers, to join the exchange. 2. Overemphasis on the marketing advantages of participation and failure to perceive and promote the provision of non-bank credit and the clearing process as their most valuable services. 3. Conflicts of interest between exchange owners and their member clients and debasement of the value of their trade credits, their internal currencies, resulting from membership agreements that are fuzzy and or disadvantageous to the members or clients. Limited scope and scale. The vast majority of commercial trade exchanges are small local operations that serve a few hundred members. In most cases, the bulk of the member businesses offer services or soft goods rather than hard goods like manufactured products and commodities for which there is strong and consistent demand. Media, advertising, hospitality, tourism, entertainment, and other discretionary products and services comprise a large portion of the offerings in many trade exchanges. These and other business lines that have prices that are fuzzy and negotiable, rather than fixed and advertised, are usually well represented, making the value of the internal trade credits harder to pin down than in the fiat currencies in which units they are denominated. Further, trade exchanges have been limited by their almost exclusive focus on the retail level of business-to-business trading. While retailers and service providers are the most readily available client prospects, the greatest potential lies in connecting suppliers and customers throughout all levels of the supply chain, including wholesalers, manufacturers, and basic commodity producers. But suppliers beyond the retail level are, more often than not, located in different geographical areas. That implies the need for small local exchanges to cooperate by networking together to extend their geographic reach and the range of goods and services available to their members. Such trade exchange networks would allow each participant to use their local trade credits to pay what they owe to their more distant suppliers. I've long argued that the apparent conflict between wider geographic reach and local control can be solved by networking small local exchanges together based on information sharing and common standards of operation that allow trade exchanges to provide their members with credits that are locally controlled but useful over wider areas. The value proposition. Trade exchange operators generally recognize that the main value propositions they offer to their members consist of 1. The competitive advantage of having privileged access to an existing membership base which provides them with a group of potential new customers. 2. active brokering services by which exchange operators assist their members to find customers for their offerings and suppliers of their needs and wants. 3. The ability to pay for purchases using internal trade credits instead of cash. However, their emphasis has been too much upon the marketing advantages of membership that are inherent in the first two of these items, and not enough on the financial advantages of the third. It is the credit clearing service which is the most distinctive feature of trade exchange operations and satisfies the greatest need of small and medium-sized enterprises that have limited access to bank credit. The dysfunctions and flaws in the political money system result in distortions in the economy that cause most SMEs to sell less of their products and services than they are actually capable of providing. This excess capacity is not so much a matter of overexpansion as it is a lack of money on the part of potential customers. The greatest value proposition that a credit clearing service provides to participants is access to lines of credit without reliance on the banking system. The trade credits thus created amount to an internal currency that clients can use to pay one another instead of using the usual political currencies, which are more difficult and expensive to acquire, which in turn enables them to sell more of the goods and services they are able to provide. Many exchanges intentionally limit the number of clients or members in a particular line of business that they will accept in order to assure them a competitive advantage. If one sees the marketing advantages as the main value proposition provided to exchange members, then it makes sense to accept only a few restaurants or hair salons, for example, in a particular town or neighborhood. But if the main value proposition of exchange membership is the moneyless clearing or offset of purchases against sales, then the more the merrier. The value and usefulness of a credit clearing network, just as with any other network, grows geometrically as the size of the network increases. Particular grounds for exclusion and offers of exclusivity to prospective members need to be seriously reconsidered. The fact is that credit clearing can work for everyone who provides some desired goods or services to the market, and the larger the number of participants in the trade exchange, the more useful membership will be to all. Operations and agreements. Certain clauses that have sometimes been included in membership agreements have jeopardized the viability of trade exchanges and retarded their growth. Specifically, these are clauses pertaining to the trade exchange's own trading account and its ability to participate as a member, as well as the provider of credit clearing services. But such a dual role can easily lead to serious conflicts of interest. As third-party record keepers and managers of their members' collective credit, trade exchanges have a professional responsibility to put their members' interests first. They must earn and maintain the trust of their clients and must assure the continued value of their internal trade credits. There are two major conflict of interest issues which have sometimes arisen in the management of trade exchanges. The first is called cherry picking, which is the ability of a trade exchange operator, based on its insider information and prior knowledge, to acquire the best offerings of its members before the other members even get to know about them. This has become far less prevalent among established exchanges, but may still be an issue in the case of startups. The second and more serious issue derives from the excessive credit lines allocated either to the exchange owners or particular member clients. In the first case, it allows the owners to spend more trade credits than they earn as revenue from operations and to outcompete other participants or members in the system. In the second case, credit lines that are larger than justified by potential sales may be offered to prospective members as a recruitment tool. The resultant ballooning of debits and credits in the system, credit inflation, makes credits harder to spend and results in the debasement of the value of the internal trade credits and the loss of confidence in the trade exchange management. As a result, members may seek ways to differentiate their money prices from their trade credit prices, or may increasingly demand part of the payment to be in cash. While such blended trades may be reasonable for covering the seller's cash expenses, particularly when the amount of a sale is large, both of these practices diminish the usefulness and credibility of the trade exchange system. Proposed remedies. How might these problems be remedied? The problem of cherry picking can be handled by limiting both what the system account can buy and when it can buy it. The system account should not be allowed to buy anything from its members for the purpose of reselling it, but should be restricted to buying only those goods and services that it commonly needs to conduct its business operations, that is, to provide services to its members. Further, it should not make any purchase until the offering has been made generally available to the entire membership for some reasonable period of time. With regard to the line of credit allocated to the system trading account, it should be based on the same qualifying criteria that are applied to any other account. It should have no special privileged access to trade credit. Ideally, the credit allocation process should be transparent and based on objective criteria. The credit allocation algorithm may include a number of factors, such as those shown in Figure 15.1, but with the main emphasis on their trade credit earning potential and history averaged over some reasonable period of time. Figure 15.1 is titled Possible Credit Allocation Criteria, and it is suggested by Richard Logie. Here are the 10 credit allocation criteria. Cash sales history, exchange sales history, rating and type of goods or services, reputation as buyer, reputation as seller, years in business, years a member of the exchange, fee payment history, complaint history, and credit bureau rating. In regard to these practices, some trade exchanges are better managed than others, but the remedies and restrictions proposed above need to become industry standards and formally specified in membership agreements. Industry trade associations like the IRTA have done much to foster the adoption of such standards of practice through their own certification and branding programs, but as a membership association, they can only recommend but not enforce them. I've provided, in Appendix A, a generalized draft of a proposed membership agreement, which could be applied to either for-profit, cooperative, or mutual credit clearing exchanges. IRTA, IRTA, also has its own model membership agreement, which I expect may have been subjected to expert legal review. It may be freely downloadable from the IRTA website. Tapping the vast potential market. As I have maintained throughout my work over more than four decades, the greatest need for civilization overall is for systems of exchange that are able to transcend the dysfunctional, debt-based political fiat money system through direct clearing of debits and credits of buyers and sellers themselves. The most important roles that trade exchanges play are providing their members with the means of obtaining credit, liquidity, to use in the moneyless exchange of their goods and services, and credit clearing as the way for members to pay one another. The market for such clearing services is virtually unlimited and worldwide, but to tap that market, it will be necessary for exchange operators to think outside of the conventional box. So, what are the necessary actions required to realize that potential? The short answer to that is that credit clearing exchanges need to attract a much larger and more diverse membership base. As pointed out above, the value and usefulness of a credit clearing network grows geometrically as the size of the network increases. The obvious way to achieve that is to make it easy and inexpensive to join an exchange. Existing pricing schedules for trade exchange services need to be completely reviewed and revised. Trade exchange operators need to find ways of reducing the costs of participation in order to make membership more attractive. It costs nothing to open a credit union or bank account. Any alternative payment system must justify its membership fees in comparison to that. It is said that nothing succeeds like success, and the challenge is to find the right combination of services and implementation strategies to get the success spiral started. During the early stages, it has been appropriate for trade exchanges to emphasize the competitive advantage and brokering services that they provide for their members. But as the size and diversity of the network is increased, the financial advantages of membership become much more apparent and significant. And as scale expands, revenues also increase, allowing services to be offered at lower cost. As mentioned, another aspect of member diversity has to do with the supply chain. If geometric growth in both membership and trading volume is to be realized, a trade exchange must include members that offer products and services from all levels of the supply chain, not only retailers, but also wholesalers, manufacturers, basic commodity producers, independent professional service providers, and ultimately employees at every level. Trade exchange operators must actively solicit members on each of these levels. If a trade exchange has a retail member, it should try to recruit the wholesale companies that supply that retail member. Then it should try to recruit the manufacturing companies that supply those wholesalers. Then try to recruit the basic commodity producers that supply those manufacturers. And so on, until the reciprocity loop is eventually closed by recruiting the employees and customers who are supplied by the retailers. In this way, each participant will be able to pay their suppliers by means of credit clearing, as depicted in Figure 15.2. As mentioned earlier, that implies the need for exchanges either to operate over a wider geographical area or, more importantly, to have effective reciprocity agreements with other trade exchanges in other regions. The vision of a global network of independent trade exchanges that could result from such agreements is an attractive one that the industry could work toward establishing. At the present time, this broad reach is being achieved either by direct acquisition of small local exchanges by a few larger companies, leading to consolidation within the industry, or by franchising. But the best approach, in my opinion, is by associating small local independent exchanges into wide area networks on the basis of standard practices and protocols that assure the integrity of the overall network and protect the interests of all participants by assuring that all trade credits of the various local exchanges maintain equal value. Further, each qualifying member of a trade exchange should be allocated an internal line of credit, which should be interest-free. If it is not, the credit clearing alternative could end up replicating the dysfunctional political money system. It is these lines of credit that enable the creation of trade credits, which constitute the money supply within a credit clearing circle. And as described in previous chapters, it is necessary at any given time for some members' balances to be negative or in debit in order for other members' balances to be positive. So it makes no sense for those with debit balances to be penalized by the imposition of interest on their balances. As E.C. Riegel has pointed out, since money is the lifeblood of business, and only the impecunious can supply this vital element through bank loans, it is adverse to the social welfare to put bars against the borrower. The same argument holds true in a credit clearing exchange. Since those who have not yet earned trade credits are the only ones who can start the process of creating trade credits, it is adverse to the welfare of trade exchange members to put bars, like interest charges, against the debitor. The costs of exchange operation ought to be borne by all those who benefit from membership. In a credit clearing circle, the total of all account debits must always equal the total of all account credits, which makes the overall system balance equal to zero at all times. The interest-free feature follows the long-standing business practice of trading on open account, which means a supplier ships goods to a customer but allows the customer a certain period of time in which to pay the invoice. Within a trade exchange, that practice of selling on credit is organized on a multilateral basis instead of a bilateral basis. If the industry is to tap the huge potential market for moneyless credit clearing services, the provision of no-interest credit will be crucial. Unlike banks, then, trade exchange system revenues will be obtained not from interest on loans, but a fee-for-service basis. In this case, the amounts cleared. While operating trade exchanges each have their own revenue model, which may include periodic membership fees, brokerage fees, advertising fees, risk premiums, and penalties, I believe that the main source of revenue ought to be transaction fees. The three issues that are raised in regard to lines of credit are how to determine an appropriate debit limit for each account, how to assure performance of contract on each account, and how to cover the inevitable bad debt losses. Conventional business, especially banking, has developed answers to all of these questions, but improved approaches can be worked out along the lines that have already been covered in Chapter 12, in the two sections, Balance Limits and Settlement, Providing Surety of Contract, and an insurance fund. On the question of an insurance fund for bad debts, let me add some further thoughts to those above. We've already discussed the possible revenue sources and proposed that the bulk of trade exchange revenues should be derived from those members who obtain the greatest benefit from their membership, those who are able to clear more of their transactions through the system. That implies fees according to the volume of transactions cleared. To cover bad debts, there can be an insurance fund against which defaults can be written off. This fee should be only as large as needed to cover prospective bad debt losses and should not be allowed to morph into an interest charge. Any resulting increase in the amount of the insurance fund beyond the amount of reasonably expected losses should be periodically returned to the members. A further important feature is transparency in the operation of the exchange. Full and timely disclosure is necessary to enable the participants to evaluate the soundness of the operation and the value of their trade credits at any point in time. What about taxes? People often ask about the tax implications of trading that is mediated using private currencies and direct credit clearing. The short answer is that they are the same as conventional money transactions. The purpose of alternative exchange is not the avoidance of taxes, but to provide traders with greater control over their own credit, to circumvent the dysfunctions inherent in the centralized political money and banking system, and to save the costs associated with conventional banking, including the interest on borrowed money. In the early days of the commercial barter industry, exchange operators and their members were subjected to harassment by the IRS because the IRS acted on the presumption that their intention was to avoid paying taxes. That issue was settled years ago by an agreement that trade exchanges would provide the IRS with annual reports about the members' trade credit income using a Form 1099-B, which is similar to the Form 1099 that is used to report money income of independent contractors. Any tax due on trade credit profit would be paid in U.S. dollar currency. But if the purchases made by a business member using trade credits qualify as business expenses, their net trade credit profit will be small or negative, and thus their tax liability will not be significant. The story of Sardex. Unlike the great majority of commercial trade exchanges which have sprung up since the 1970s, Sardex was established not merely to succeed as a profitable business, but also to achieve a social purpose. The four idealistic young men who founded Sardex in 2009 had been friends since childhood and were aiming to bolster the economy of their home island of Sardinia. Just as with the Swiss Veer before it, this higher purpose, in my view, has been largely responsible for the success of Sardex. The year before Sardex commenced operations, I had already been contacted by one of its founders, which began a correspondence that has continued off and on to the present day. In that interval, I was twice invited, in 2015 and 2016, and visited the island to get a close-up look and to meet the other founders and managers. Following my 2015 visit, I published a report on my website. I came away with a pretty good understanding of how Sardex operated at that time, and the impression that the Sardex structures, procedures, and protocols come closer to optimal than any other trade exchange I had seen. When I asked about the key factors that accounted for their success, this is some of what I was told. 1. The founders were dedicated to the mission to relocalize and rehumanize the economy and to reconnect local businesses with one another by enabling the creation of interest-free local liquidity based on the capacity of each to produce and sell commonly desired goods and services. 2. Social solidarity and cultural cohesion, while very important and part of the mission, were not a pre-existing factor that would account for their early success. In fact, they had to work hard to develop social solidarity and cooperation amongst their members, but that began to change as members' interaction became more frequent and beneficial. One Sardex account broker told me, quote, "I can see how behavior of many of our members has changed. When the financial crisis first began, they were starting to lay off employees or cut their wages, and they were reluctant to spend their euros. This made matters worse as the circulation of money slowed down. But as they began to participate in the process of earning and spending trade credits, they began to increase pay to their workers and invest in their education. In one case, when a member's shop was burglarized, other members stepped up to help by donating some of their trade credits to help their fellow member recover from the loss." End quote. That anecdote demonstrates the differences in behavior that results when people experience scarcity compared to when they experience abundance. In this case, the scarcity of euros caused behavior to change in the direction of reduced willingness to spend and the resultant contraction of overall economic activity. But their experience with trade credit was very different. Realizing the greater availability of trade credits and finding it easier to earn them leads people to experience abundance and to be more generous and spend more liberally. 3. I was surprised to learn that the Sardex revenue model differs from the usual fee structure of other trade exchanges. Sardex relies mainly upon initiation fees and annual membership fees collected in euros. They had decided early on to stop charging fees on transactions. For me, that approach is counterintuitive in that I have long held the view that recruitment would be most successful if joining were made easy, low-cost, and risk-free, and that it seems reasonable to apply the principle that users pay in proportion to the amount of services they receive. In this case, that principle would mean that those that receive more credit clearing services should pay more to support the operation. Well, this may be a case in which successful practice trumps rational theory, but it occurs to me that there may be local cultural differences that might account for this preference. There is some logic in this approach in that if the monthly cost of participation is relatively fixed, members would seek to maximize the benefits of their membership by trading more within the network. Initiation fees were set according to the size of the business, and at the time ranged from 150 to 1,000 euros. Annual membership fees were likewise based mainly on turnover and ranged from 350 to 2,500 euros. 4. Strong member support is provided by a staff of brokers who help to arrange trades, especially for those that have a high earning capacity and maintain high positive trade credit balances. 5. Recruitment strategy that tries to replicate the supply chain, that is, to bring in businesses that are the suppliers of existing members or prospective members. 6. Solidarity threshold. Requirement that members offer their goods and services for trade credit at the same prices as their euro prices, and that payment be accepted 100% in trade credit on all transactions of less than 1,000 euros. Blended trades, that is, payments that involve payment using a combination of trade credits and euros, are allowed on larger purchases according to a sliding scale. 7. A. Sardex accepts as members only companies that have a registered office in Sardinia. This promotes social solidarity and excludes large multinational corporations. I am fully supportive of this, and indeed have long recommended that multinational companies be permanently excluded from local trade exchanges because they enjoy privileges that give them an unfair advantage over smaller local enterprises. B. Sardex avoids saturation, that is, accepting too many members that offer the same line of products or services. As I have pointed out before, this practice makes sense in the early stages of establishing credit clearing as a credible means of exchange and an effective source of local liquidity. But ultimately, I believe that membership must be open to any community-based small or medium enterprise that meets the basic qualifications for membership. Of course, not all of them will qualify for lines of credit. Those which do not must earn trade credits before they can spend them. 8. Sardex is fully compliant with reporting and tax regulations. Transparency is a matter of fundamental importance. 9. Sardex, like other trade exchanges, places strong emphasis on monetizing the unused capacity of members by connecting unused supplies with unmet needs, which is a primary benefit of credit clearing services in general. A recent academic paper argued that the success of Sardex can be understood from four points of view: human, social, political, and institutional, and argues that the sociological reasons are equal in importance to the others. Even as early as 2015, the Sardex company had been consulting with various interested groups and was helping to replicate their system in 7 other regions around Italy. They were also getting ready to bring consumers into the trading community by launching a rebate program to make Sardex better known, enhance the circulation of local trade credits, and stimulate more sales for their business members. One thing that gave Sardex an enormous boost and propelled it to prominence throughout Italy and the world was the publication of an article in La Repubblica, one of Italy's leading daily newspapers. An eventual moneyless trading network. I strongly believe that if commercial trade exchanges are to survive and thrive, they must eventually associate into wider networks in order to enable a member to use their local trade credits as payment for purchases made from members of other local exchanges farther away, just as banks have networked together to allow deposits in a local bank to be used to make payments virtually anywhere in the world. This capacity for cross-system trading will add tremendous value to exchange membership. My vision of what that will look like and how it can be achieved will be further elaborated in a subsequent chapter. Moneyless trading has, over the past several decades, gone through stages of experimentation, trial and error, and small-scale application. The principles of credit and exchange are now well understood, tested, and proven. As they are more effectively applied, their enormous possibilities will become generally apparent. Sufficient amounts of resources will be allocated to their further development and implementation, and the world will be forever changed. End of chapter 15.